I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. We often admire, even romanticize, the work ethic of people like Steve Jobs or Michael Jackson or even Martha Stewart, known for being demanding perfectionists. A new paper in the Review of General Psychology suggests there's a downside to the pursuit of perfection with potential for health consequences. Perfectionists may look confident from the outside, but it could be a mask for feelings of inadequacy and inferiority. They can also be difficult to work with and also difficult to have as a parent. Today on Radio Times, what it means to be a perfectionist and what to do about it. Gordon Flett joins us. He's a professor of psychology at York University in Toronto. Gordon Flett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
We're happy to have you. Also with us is Patricia DiBartolo. She's a professor of clinical psychology and adolescent anxiety disorders at Smith College, joining us from the studios of Smith College. And Patricia, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be here.
Also with us is Noah Kagiyama, and he works with students at the Juilliard School and also at the New World Symphony in Miami. He blogs at bulletproofmusician.com, and we wanted to have him on as well because professional and aspiring musicians are often under a lot of pressure to perform perfectly. And Noah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Gordon Flett, and even begin with this new study that was just published in the Review of General Psychology. That's a journal of the American Psychological Association, talking about the true risks associated with being a perfectionist. What did you find?
Well, what we found in this paper was that perfectionism, when it's people are experiencing distress and despair, which is quite common, seems to be associated with all the other factors that tend to amplify the risk for a particular individual, sense of hopelessness, a sense of psychological, emotional pain. And that combined with some of the tendencies of perfectionists, such as their planfulness and often the hiding behind a front where they don't let on that anything is actually going wrong with their lives, these tend to combine and heighten the risk in ways that is really quite alarming. So the message of our paper was that perfectionism is identified as a risk factor for people, but we think that it's much stronger and has potentially lethal consequences for some people, unfortunately.
Well, in fact, you talk about the association between being a perfectionist and suicide, a very troubling connection.
Yes, and it's consistently there with particular elements of perfectionism, such as one element we call socially prescribed perfectionism, which is that sense of, you know, pressure that's imposed on ourselves to be perfect, either from specific other people or society, and the sense of hopelessness that's built in with somebody who's extreme in this tendency because they feel that they can never live up to these impossible expectations, and even doing well is going to add more pressure to them on top of what they already are experiencing.
Patricia, let me turn to you, and how would you like us to define perfectionism for our listeners?
Well, I think that Dr. Flett and I have had a number of conversations over the years professionally about how to define it. And I think the field in general has really been working hard to identify what makes someone a perfectionist. What are the pieces or components? Socially prescribed perfectionism falls under what I would call even more broadly the rubric of evaluative concerns, which is that a person is primarily concerned about pressure from others, about fear of failure and making mistakes. And that's one central piece, I think, of what defines perfectionism and really likely the part that creates the most significant vulnerability for individuals in terms of psychological distress.
So should we see it as a kind of a mask for this, you know, sense of feeling that I'm not good enough, you know, I'm an imposter in a certain kind of way?
I do think that there are relationships between perfectionism and tendencies, as Dr. Flett was mentioning, to self-conceal. They're not often honest with others about their mistakes, seeing them as being equivalent to failure. So they're not likely to admit right up front when they've erred in some way. And I think that that often fuels their self-concealment, fuels the sense that no one would accept them if they were to admit to their mistakes. And they can often feel real pressure from others to be perfect. And all of these things together, I think, often create this panic that they feel imposterish even when they're successful.
And no, I want to get you in, but one question back to you, Patricia. So what does a mistake then mean to someone who is a perfectionist?
Well, it's really quite debilitating. It often is a way in which they begin to define themselves. So whereas most of us would see error or mistake as something that's typical of being human and to be expected in our day-to-day lives, even though we try to avoid them, a perfectionist would see a mistake as being a signal of their thorough incompetence as a human being or their unlovability in some way.
So they feel incompetent and unlovable because they're incompetent?
You can often find that those two things tend to get in some way confused together in talking with perfectionists, which I think, as you might imagine, would be you could see how that would lead to the result that Dr. Flett's study was addressing, which is suicidality.
No, let me get you in on the conversation. And you work with students at Juilliard School. You work with a New World Symphony in Miami. We're talking about high-level musicians, high-level performers here. How much are they haunted by the pursuit of perfection based on your experience working with musicians?
I think it's a big part of everyone's day-to-day concerns. I mean, everyone spends hours and hours every day trying to hone their skills and reach ever higher levels of I don't want to call it perfection, but excellence. And especially if we're talking about the audition scene with going for jobs at big orchestras like the New York Phil or the Philadelphia Orchestra, any little tiny mistake or glitch or accident can certainly wipe you from contention in a very quick moment. So that's certainly a concern. But on the other hand, if they don't learn to find ways of really going for it and trusting themselves and pushing past this fear of making mistakes, that's also not going to lead to much success either. I mean, that leads to tentative, careful, cautious performances, which nobody's really excited about or looking for either.
In fact, you've kind of deconstructed perfectionism based on some of your own experience as a musician yourself and some of the work that you've been doing about the combination of strivings and concerns. Can you break that down for us, Noah?
Sure. It's a little bit like the other psychologists have been mentioning with for overly concerned with what other people are going to think or what they may say or what the consequences may be, especially in the moment of performing, it makes it very difficult for us to strive for these, you know, brilliant moments or higher levels of excellence that we're all capable of. I was speaking with a conductor recently who often listens to singers perform for him, and he says he can tell that there's something greater behind what they're actually sharing with the audience or with him. And once he can sort of develop this trust with them and get them to let loose and trust themselves a little more, they start showing what it is that they're really capable of instead of trying to be careful and trying to avoid making mistakes.
I mean, it seems like an extreme kind of self-consciousness that, let's say you're auditioning for the Philadelphia Orchestra, extreme self-consciousness you might have in trying to be perfect.
Exactly, yes, yeah.
Let me go back to you, Gordon Flett, and Noah talked about the pursuit of excellence, and I want to make sure that we don't confuse perfectionism with this pursuit of excellence. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, that's a very key distinction. When parents ask us what advice we have, we say, you know, you've got to focus on encouraging for high standards, but not impossible standards. The difference between striving for perfection versus striving for excellence, and there really is a fine line between being a conscientious person versus a hyper-conscientious, obsessed, work-focused person that can drive oneself and other people right over the edge. I'm really glad Noah's on the program because I've often thought about performers and, you know, looking at this, we did a study back in the 90s on professional performers in Toronto, including many musicians, and found that the most perfectionistic among these world-class performers are ones who said they really had no satisfaction, that there's always something that they could be working on, that they weren't happy while performing. So there's a real lack of enjoyment, which reflects that difference between striving for excellence and enjoying your accomplishments versus feeling that it has to be absolutely perfect. And when you approximate that, you now have to focus on being perfect the next time, so you never really get to linger over that positive feeling of you know, any satisfaction.
And did you find that as well, Noah?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a big difference between people who are able to strive for excellence and still yet enjoy the moment of performing and those who are, even in the moment of performing, nitpicking every little detail to such an extent that not only do their performances suffer, and the audience can pick up on that as well often, but they absolutely have no enjoyment of it, and it becomes more of like a chore or a job from day to day.
Patricia, let me go back to you, and where does this desire, this demand for perfection, where does that come from? Does it come from demanding perfectionistic parents?
There are a lot of theories. We need more data, I think. There are many ways in which parenting has been implicated, either through role modeling, high-achieving professional parents who themselves role model for their children, kind of an exacting standard of performance, to parenting in which parents only selectively and conditionally provide love and attention to their children when they are excelling, when they're flawless in some way. So much of the literature does implicate parenting and discuss parenting, although I think that the field is recognizing that those kinds of models may be incomplete because there have been some really interesting genetic data that have also indicated that these things may actually have genetic liabilities. And we need to think, I think, a little bit more fully and complexly about not only the ways within a family, the various mechanisms within a family that may reinforce perfectionistic tendencies, which could include some genetic loading or modeling or conditional support, but also then the other complicated relationships and environments that could serve as vulnerabilities as well. So parents and teachers and cultures and so forth that may also contribute.
Do you want to add to that, Gordon Flood? You've done so much research on perfectionism.
Sure.
Does it seem like it runs in families?
It does run in families. You can find families where only one person is a perfectionist, but typically it does. And as Patricia had said, there's a lot of focus on families, but now it's becoming much broader. And importantly, cultural factors need to take center stage for a while here in terms of what could be a contributing factor. Some have suggested that with the internet, people who are public figures who make mistakes are centered out much more than they possibly could. So a kid could get the sense, well, look what happens to somebody who's accomplished and then makes a mistake. So there's great fearfulness of you know, being identified that way. Another factor that we're starting to focus more on is the role of peers and friends and the school setting in terms of the hyper-competitiveness among younger people. A lot of what's going on seems to be driven what we call social comparison as a factor. And, of course, you would see that in developing musicians as well, the notion that not only do I have to be perfect, but I have to do better than everybody else because I want to be number one. And when you start to play that social comparison game, you can always find somebody who seems to be doing as well or better. And that's another thing that would take away from your satisfaction because you're saying, well, now I achieved the goal, but somebody else did it quicker or as quickly as I did. And I have to not only be perfect, but I have to be at the top.
Well, we are talking about perfection, the downside of perfection. And that's Gordon Flood. He's a professor of psychology at York University in Toronto. Also with us is Patricia DiBartolo. She's a professor of clinical psychology and adolescent anxiety disorders. That's at Smith College. And Noah Kageyama is with us as well. He's a performance psychologist for the Juilliard School and the New World Symphony in Miami. He blogs at bulletproofmusician.com. We want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Does this sound like you or someone you know? Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents the U.S. premiere of Carlos Amorales' film The Man Who Did All Things Forbidden, 2014. Carlos Amorales, a contemporary artist whose art explores the culture and values of his native Mexico through a variety of media. A screening of the film will be followed by a Q&A session with the artist, Carlos Amorales, at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Sunday, October 21st at 5:30. Open to the public with limited seating. Details at 215-235-7469 or philamuseum.org.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center joins you in supporting WHYY. With over 20 community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Penn's Heart and Vascular Center is committed to delivering advanced treatment options, personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at pennheart.org or 800-789-PENN. Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center. Your life is worth Penn Medicine.
Morristown Friends School proudly supports WHYY and is hosting an admissions open house on Sunday, October 19th at 2 p.m. Founded in 1785, Morristown Friends offers rigorous academics coupled with a spiritual and ethical education program for students in preschool through grade 12. More information, videos, and all open house dates can be found online at mfriends.org. That's mfriends.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about what it means to be a perfectionist, the good, the bad, and we'll be talking about how and why to treat it. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Now, let me go back to you. You do not like the word perfectionist. You like the word optimalist. Tell us why.
Yeah, I think perfection, one, is sort of an illusion to begin with. A lot of times I'll work with students or other musicians who feel like they may have had a perfect performance. But then if I ask them to listen back to it a week or a month later, they realize that there's actually much more that they could have done. Like Dr. Flett was saying, it just raises the bar for the next performance. And I think if musicians are more inclined to focus on growing and continuing to develop and pursuing, you know, this path of mastery that never really quite ends, they end up experiencing a lot more fulfillment and are able to be a little bit more patient with wherever they happen to be at any given moment. So I think because perfection tends to be a fiction anyhow, shooting for excellence or more optimal level of performance given one's level of preparation and experience and current skill set, is a much more satisfying and realistic way to approach one's career and one's life.
Does that make sense to you, Patricia?
I would absolutely agree. I think that you know, in essence, it is elusive. And I think that is often the first bit of psychoeducation you would provide to someone, whether you're working as a coach or a tutor, an educator or a clinician dealing with someone who's really riddled with and potentially paralyzed by perfectionistic strivings, is to point out that it's virtually an impossibility, and that in fact what often happens with people who are perfectionistic is even in those rare moments when they feel that they may have been as close to perfect as they can possibly be, they are often, as Gordon was just indicating a moment ago, critiquing how much effort they needed to put in to be perfect. So in essence, they satisfaction is often elusive as well for people who are perfectionistic.
Gordon, if you can pick up on that, I'm thinking even the kind of conversation a perfectionist might be having with themselves while they're working on a project, they're doing something at home, perhaps, you know, performing for the Philadelphia Orchestra. But what is that conversation that they are having inside their head?
Well, it's a pretty harsh one. Perfectionists are notorious for being very self-critical. And, you know, that can be in terms of the outcome. And some use the self-criticism as motivation. You know, if I'm hard on myself, then I'll get closer to that goal. And in the meantime, of course, they're generating all kinds of stress and arousal for themselves, which is why perfectionism has been linked with health problems as well. And a key thing that's pretty evident in emerging research is that perfectionists are very low in self-compassion. They're not kind to themselves. Perhaps that's because they have had someone who served that role as a critic over the years, and they've internalized that. And really learning to lighten up on oneself, and it's almost as if they're saying to themselves, yeah, I know perfection is an illusion. I know it's not attainable and that nobody's perfect, but what if I'm that one person? And maybe if I push myself and I'm hard on myself, I will be the one. So they sort of acknowledge that nobody can be perfect, but they still seem driven to try to be that unique person.
Does that sound like people you work with, Noah?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think sometimes, too, with musicians, we forget that the whole point of it is ultimately to give the audience or the listener some sort of an experience that changes their day. And when we get too caught up into the little tiny details of whether a note was slightly in tune or out of tune, or if we cracked a note, and we get too hung up on those technical minutiae, it makes it very difficult for us to focus on making sure we give a compelling performance that audiences remember and experience some degree of emotions about.
Does that mean taking the focus off oneself and even some of those technical proficiencies and think about the audience?
In the practice room, we absolutely can focus on trying to increase our technical capacity, but in the moment of a performance, it's a very different task at hand, and being able to simply trust ourselves, let loose, and go for what it is that we would love to create in that moment without being constantly analyzing or judgmental in our own mind as we're performing is really the objective. And actually, John Cage had a great saying, you know, not to analyze and create at the same time because they're very different processes.
So, I mean, something to think about, right, Patricia? Analyze and create at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the self-talk can be really have a really significant a negative impact. And I think as well, what you hear in the self-talk, as Gord was just saying, was this total lack of self-compassion. Sometimes there's also the possibility that they may engage in that same kind of judgmental and critical self-talk in relation to others, which is interesting. And that can make it difficult for them interpersonally as well. So not just that they feel like they're being pressured by others to be perfect, but that they themselves might hold extraordinarily high standards for the people around them, either family or coworkers, et cetera. And these can be individuals who will experience a lot of social rejection and, in fact, won't have individuals who are reflecting back any kind of compassion toward them because they find it quite difficult to build relationships, which just exacerbates the cycle.
So, Gordon, how do you suggest we work with people who are perfectionists? What's the best way to deal with them if you're not a perfectionist?
If you're not a perfectionist, the duck and cover would be the
really?
First thing.
Really, I mean, suggest. Really, it's that potentially dangerous or scary.
Yeah. If somebody's hypercritical all the time, we know from extensive research in general that the criticism component, where people are feeling that they're being criticized and judged negatively, is a huge factor that just shuts down relationships. And you know, the key that people have to learn is to be accepting of themselves, but also of other people. But it just seems that some people are hardwired to be judging all the time, and that sense of being judged and scrutinized makes somebody very defensive and can lead to them just avoiding the other person and getting away, so that then creates a sense of loneliness. And often people are hypercritical perfectionists are really confused, like, why don't people want to be around me more? Because they don't really understand how automatic their tendencies have become.
Well, Patricia, let's say someone has an employee who's a perfectionist, or perhaps their boss or supervisor is a perfectionist. You know, they have to deal with this person every day. What do you suggest they do?
That's a tough one. Like Gordon, I'm not sure I have tremendously effective advice. I think that, you know, in some ways it may be useful to try to, I don't know, accrue evidence of your efficacy just so you have something to benchmark the criticism against if it's a supervisor of yours who seems that you're never good enough, so that if someone else came into the conversation in some way, say a superior of your boss, they'd be able to judge for him or herself whether, in fact, the criticism is warranted. I think that it is, but it definitely is quite difficult because I think the judgment, the self-talk and the negativity can be difficult to get around. And I'm not sure that we fully understand how to address it. I think one of the ironies here, too, is that many people who are more other-oriented perfectionists don't end up in therapy because they don't see that they need to be changed. They may be driving other people into therapy because they're miserable and trying to deal with an unreasonable supervisor, etc. But they're often not brought into, they often don't self-identify as even having a problem necessarily, and that makes it even more difficult to inspire any kind of change.
No, I'm going to toss the same question to you about sort of how one deals with someone who is a perfectionist, and I'm thinking if we're talking about musicians in an orchestra, we're talking about probably everyone who is a perfectionist. I don't know how they deal with each other, or is that an issue?
Well, what I found, this may not be the perfect answer, but what I found is that when people see that their perfectionism is getting in the way of their larger goals, so if they're finding that they're not able to perform as well as they know they're capable of, or they're not getting the sorts of results that they want in auditions or competitions because they're too fixated on little tiny details that, in the grand scheme of things, aren't serving the larger purpose, they seem much more open to reevaluating or perhaps restructuring what their goals or their focus are. So, for instance, as a tennis example, you know, the top players in the world don't hit 100% of their first serves in. And if they fixate too much on trying to improve their first serve percentage, what ends up happening is they lose more points on first serve, because it means that they have to hit a safer serve, they have to take a little speed off, not go for the lines quite as much. And so the other player across the net has an easier time returning the ball. And so if they, for instance, could see an equivalent sort of thing in music, that in trying to perfect your first serve, you're actually making your chances of getting the results you want lower, I think they start becoming more open to reevaluating what they can do otherwise to reprioritize where perfection might fall in the grand scheme of things.
Well, I know you learned some of this stuff from a sports psychologist when you were struggling as a musician, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
And since I'm drawing from what Olympic athletes and others tell themselves or how they think about their performance?
You know, one of the interesting things about top athletes, from what I understand, is that in the moment of a performance, their experience can often be very different than what they do in training. So in training and in practice, they work very hard to look at these little tiny details and to try to erase the errors and try to overcome mistakes. But in the moment, and this is what seems to separate the very top athletes from those who are elite but maybe not quite at that level, in the moment when they have to serve the ball or when they have to run the race or whenever that moment arrives, they're able to put all the doubts, all the fears, all the preoccupations with successes aside for that moment in time and just do the very best that they can. Mm. Afterwards, they might nitpick and might review things and analyze, but in that moment, they're able to leave it behind and have more of a peak performance experience.
Let me get, looks like Becky from Kennett Square to join our conversation. Becky, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Go ahead. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
As a perfectionist myself, I completely concur with nearly everything that is being said. But I think the point that I wanted to make, as well as kind of a question that I'd like to pose, is in regard to parenting. I'm a mother of two young children, and I'm trying very hard to parse my perfectionism as I am parenting them. But at the same time, I want to instill in them a sense of caring about things and wanting to strive to do things as well as possible, not necessarily perfectly. I try to check that. But I just feel that there's just a cultural problem with saying, well, good enough is good enough. Mm. And that just there's this blasé attitude toward just doing things in an acceptable fashion as opposed to just having this intrinsic desire to really want to do it as well, perhaps perfectly, as possible.
Well, and Becky, I think there's something in between those two poles that you just put out there, but let me see what Patricia has to say. Patricia, go ahead.
Well, I think, yes, I mean, that this is often difficult to translate for adults and particularly hard for children and adolescents. They might not understand this kind of distinction, as Gordon was mentioning, kind of that fine line between striving for perfection versus striving for excellence. I think that Noah also alluded to the focus on putting in your best effort, and then wherever the performance lands is something that should in some way be considered satisfying or complete. And so, for some of my own clinical work and my own work in parenting with my children, it's often not about what the grade is on the test but whether you've studied appropriately. So once good studying habits have happened, really, then you should be satisfied with the outcome no matter where it lands. And that is the kind of distinction that I think can be helpful as you're trying to create advice in which children feel like they develop a sense of pride about a job well done and understand how kind of consistent and hard work can result in long-term satisfaction and success.
Something you said earlier, Patricia, that I underscored, which is that perfectionists often feel unlovable if they make a mistake. And I guess we want to break that somehow.
Yes, I think that messaging is always important. I love you no matter what, but I would like to see your behavior change in this fashion for the future. That is, you should actually study for your chemistry final exam, not just the night before, because I think that will make you a happier and healthier adult in the long term, is being planful and thoughtful and investing effort in your own good outcome. But I think making sure that that's distinct from whether the child gets a message that he or she is loved or accepted by the parents.
And that's Patricia DiBartolo, who joins us along with Gordon Flett and Noah Kageyama. And we are talking about perfectionism today on Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We have a Facebook comment I want to give to you, Gordon. This is from Jane, who says, some perfectionists are narcissists, making for further complications in relationships. Is Jane correct about that?
Oh, definitely. There's two types that people talk about. Neurotic perfectionists are people who tend to want to be perfect but feel they're always going to fall short. And then there's a subset that's getting increasing attention, the narcissistic perfectionist, the person who feels that they have grandiose goals, they want to be perfect, and they actually might attain it. And then these people can be very other-oriented and judgmental of others, the lesser mortals who are dragging them down. And there's a problem with self-awareness in general with people striving for perfection, but especially among the ones who feel that they are actually going to attain it someday and do see that they need to be better than everybody in a hyper-competitive sort of way. And, you know, we've been talking about primarily the neurotic perfectionist, but the narcissistic perfectionist probably is somebody who has a very different developmental pathway. There are accounts of people who have been told from a very early age that they're the golden child, that they're the one who is going to be perfect, and then they get this enormous pressure to live up to this in a way that they really self-inflate, but it's based on a very shaky sense of self-esteem and who they are. But they can wreak havoc in the lives of other people if they decide to be judgmental of others as well, according to those standards.
And Noah, I'm curious about with your work with students either at Juilliard or with musicians at the New World Symphony in Miami, do you have to sort of help them redefine what success is, what it means to do really well on the stage, for instance?
Absolutely, yes. One of the things that we often talk about is kind of a classic sports psychology paradigm, but focusing on the process as opposed to outcomes. So, you know, in the case of a performance or a test, you know, how well one does in a performance or whether one advances in a competition or whether one gets an A in a test, that's sort of a measuring stick for how effective your practice or study strategies were. There's a great story I heard recently about tennis great Pete Sampras, who, you know, as a junior was not particularly impressive. And I think in Andre Agassi's biography, he felt bad for Pete Sampras and thought that he should quit tennis while he was still young. But then, you know, one day everything came together and he started, you know, beating everybody. And what I understand about his coaching approach was that, you know, his coaches had him really focus on perfecting the art of tennis. So really elegant strokes, you know, choosing the right strokes at the right time and getting better at mastering the art of being a tennis player with less of a focus on whether or not that translated into winning points or winning matches or not. And so I think if we can adopt this focus of really making sure that our effort is there, you know, our focus is there, and we're doing all the right things to lead to success, it's a little easier also then to kind of let go of whether or not each particular performance might have been the absolute success that we would have wished it to be.
Is it also helpful to have fun?
Yeah.
Enjoy yourself.
In an audition, but that is a huge part of it. And I think when musicians are having fun, it's very apparent to the people who are listening that that is also a pleasurable and exciting experience for the performer.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about perfection. And that's Noah Kageyama, performance psychologist. Also with us, Patricia DiBartolo from Smith College and Gordon Flett from York University in Toronto. We're going to continue our conversation after this very short break, so do stay with us. Much more to talk about as we talk about some of the pros and the cons, many cons actually, associated with this desire for perfection. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents the U.S. premiere of Carlos Amarales' film The Man Who Did All Things Forbidden, 2014. Carlos Amarales, a contemporary artist whose art explores the culture and values of his native Mexico through a variety of media. A screening of the film will be followed by a Q&A session with the artist, Carlos Amarales, at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Sunday, October 21st at 5:30. Open to the public with limited seating. Details at 215-235-7469 or philamuseum.org.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center joins you in supporting WHYY. With over 20 community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Penn's Heart and Vascular Center is committed to delivering advanced treatment options. personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at PennHeart.org or 800-789-PENN. Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center. Your life is worth Penn Medicine.
Morristown Friends School proudly supports WHYY and is hosting an admissions open house on Sunday, October 19th at 2 p.m. Founded in 1785, Morristown Friends offers rigorous academics coupled with a spiritual and ethical education program for students in preschool through grade 12. More information, videos, and all open house dates can be found online at mfriends.org. That's mfriends.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about the downside of the pursuit of perfection. And again, our guests are Noah Kageyama, performance psychologist for the Juilliard School and the New World Symphony in Miami. He blogs at bulletproofmusician.com. Patricia DiBartolo, professor of clinical psychology and adolescent anxiety disorders at Smith College. And Gordon Flett, professor of psychology at York University in Toronto. Patricia, I have a Facebook comment for you from Trudy, who says perfectionism interferes with completion. And I think you were talking earlier about how perfectionists can sometimes be just paralyzed because I guess they feel like they have to be perfect.
Yes, there's an association between perfectionism and procrastination, and it can often present in a striking and kind of paradoxical way in that perfectionists can sometimes be so terrorized by the fear of failure that they actually can't get things done. Mm-hmm. So on the surface, they are failing in some way in either a job setting or an educational setting because they can't get the tasks done that are required of them, but it's because they want it to be perfect. And so they might circle around to the same first line in a report or in a draft of a document, just trying to get that sentence just perfect. And as a result, they never get it done. And so it looks from the face of it that it's someone who really doesn't seem to have very high standards when, in fact, that's the thing that's causing them to fail.
Gordon, do you think we live in a more demanding and demanding of perfection society? I'm thinking, you know, teachers now are being evaluated on their performances. People at work, including here at HYY, we get evaluated on our performances all the time. And do you think we have sort of upped the ante when it comes to perfection?
I do think so. And it goes back to what I was saying about the consequences of making a mistake and how sometimes they're very public mistakes in the internet age. So, you know, somebody who's writing an article or even on the radio could immediately get flaws pointed out by somebody through various social media or the like. And something's certainly going on in terms of this because the prevalence of perfectionism seems to be getting kind of scary. Studies with kids that look at different types now indicate some studies that perfectionists outnumber non-perfectionists. And given all the things we've talked about in terms of the cost and the life dissatisfaction, it's pretty ominous if this is the case. And that's one reason we have a newer paper where we're talking about, are we at the point where we need to start looking at the prevention of perfectionism, or at least finding ways to turn that into the excellence driving and not being so concerned catastrophically with what happens if you make a mistake, especially if it's in public.
I have something for you, Noah. This is an email from David. How much does negative motivation instigate perfectionism compared to striving motivation? I guess the idea that, you know, if you sort of call yourself a name, whether that sort of feeds into this perfectionism. Do we have Noah? I think we have lost Noah. Maybe I can put that to you, Patricia.
Well, I think that often negative motivation.
Yeah, negative motivation.
Right.
Yep.
I think Gordon was talking about that earlier, that perfectionists often believe that kind of motivation is part of what makes them successful. And I think that perfectionists, when they do seek out treatment, and usually not specifically for their perfectionism, but rather for some other problem, that they're experiencing significant depression or they've had some kind of life stress or failure at work, or a relationship challenge, when they actually seek out treatment, one of the things that they don't want to change is their perfectionism. So they want their depression to go away. But when you might suggest there are ways in which that depression is being maintained or exacerbated by their perfectionistic beliefs or approaches to the world, you can often find that there's an obstinacy about making that the target of treatment. And I think that's partially because they believe that their perfectionistic beliefs about the world are part of what made them successful. And that if they are to relinquish them, they're not quite certain how to define their sense of self or whether they, in fact, will be able to succeed and function.
Well, I will admit a mistake on the air. I forgot that Noah Kageyama had to leave us at 40 minutes after the hour, so that's why he wasn't there to answer that question. Let me get to Nancy from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for another really interesting program.
Thanks.
One point and two really quick stories. Of course, a lot of this discussion has been about art as opposed to sports, and art is not quantifiable. I mean, you have to have standards, but the best isn't necessarily the most powerful or most beautiful, which I was thinking of because many years ago, I was a high school student at the National Music Camp in Interlochen, Michigan, where the system itself actually encouraged a lot of perfectionism because they had weekly orchestral challenges for the instrumentalists, leading to, seriously, 10-year-old children with ulcers and no chance to enjoy their music, and I found that pretty scary. I've also been a dance critic over the years in several different cities, and one of the first things I learned from that was that the dancer who's the most technically perfect isn't necessarily the one you want to watch because the person may not be interesting or expressive.
Those are all really good points, Nancy. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Gordon, you want to weigh in on that at all?
Yes. The thing about it is that the outcome is often very ambiguous, and when we're talking about dancers, you know, Canada's prima ballerina, Karen Kane, in her autobiography said that she always felt like the audience was not clued into the mistakes that she had made, so that over 10,000 performances, she only enjoyed 12 or 14 of them. And her worst times were when she felt that she had made mistakes, but the audience reacted as if she was absolutely perfect, so that she felt this great sense of being an imposter. So it really is important to emphasize that how you determine whether perfection has been attained is really quite abstract, as we've mentioned. And if there's any way of finding a way to do it, the perfectionists tend to find that way to be self-critical.
Well, you know, Patricia, Nancy said a really interesting thing when it applies to dancers, professional dancers, that perhaps the one the audience watches is not the one that's perfect, that does everything perfectly, but it's the most interesting dancer.
Yeah, I really love that point. I think Noah also mentioned it earlier, which is that risk-taking is really important, in fact, for creativity and for superlative performance. It's really rare that people who play it safe and who never make mistakes are the ones who emerge as leaders and creative thinkers and so forth. So I think there's a way in which we could shift some of the messaging in our culture to be more about embracing making mistakes and trying out things that are grand and expansive. And if we fall a little short, then we still have learned something essential. And I think that if we could change some of that messaging, you know, in our educational settings and so forth, I actually think that would be getting at partially what Gordon was suggesting we might need at this point, which is a preventive program for perfectionism, because if those are the lessons we're teaching our children, they're not going to feel so riddled with anxiety about making mistakes.
Gordon, you have a program for us about how to prevent perfection?
Well, actually, I'm involved with one with one of our local school boards. We have provincial funding, and it was focused on kids in general, but the same principles apply, and that is focusing on learning as a process. And, you know, not being too afraid of making a mistake, a failure. Part of this, and advice for parents, is to point to some famous, highly accomplished people and trace their path to success, because usually it's riddled with examples of having failed and learning how to cope with that. And it's all summarized, I think, by Denzel Washington in the new Equalizer movie, when he's coaching his coworker and saying it's about progress, it's not about perfection.
Well, and what I hear both of you saying, Patricia, is that when you sort of scratch the surface of perfectionism, you see fear.
Right, absolutely. I think that's getting at that negative motivation. And it often drives behavior, but in ways, as Gordon was mentioning earlier, really do exact costs. So it creates heightened emotional distress. It ravages the physical body. One of our colleagues in Canada, Dr. Fuchsia Seurat, actually found that individuals who were very perfectionistic and focused on the self-critical part of perfectionism actually tended to die earlier. Mm-hmm. So there are ways in which we see the costs, and we really do need to address them.
Let me get Chris from Ambler to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to share, you know, my path to perfectionism and the cost of perfectionism in my own life.
Sure.
It started in an orphanage, followed by three foster homes in which I decided I had to be perfect to survive. Because I was being, each foster home changed because I was doing something that was not okay with the home. And my solution was be perfect, and then no one can find fault and move you again. So it was needed for survival, and it paid off immediately that my perfection inspired high school grades and college education and a career in the military, all of which lined up very well with perfectionism. And very successful, you know, a four-bedroom, two-and-a-half house. It had all the things, two children. And then my wife asked for a separation. Wow. And I can see now in hindsight, after a lot of personal work, including therapy, that I was not compassionate with her or my children, because you know, that was the mode. I saw everybody needed, and I wanted to pass it on to them. I thought I was doing them a favor. That perfectionism is what will get you through this very challenging life. So I've grown a lot since then, and I'm glad to be able to listen to a wonderful program like this and appreciate what the value it is to the community.
Well, Chris, I'm really glad you call into the show, because it's a really poignant story that you told about yourself, and you raise a whole host of very important issues that I want to give our guests a chance to weigh in on. So thanks to you for calling in and being so honest and so insightful about himself. And Patricia, what are your thoughts there?
Well, recall earlier when I was talking about the ways in which parenting have been implicated, I think Chris's story indicates another pathway to perfectionism that has been discussed in the literature, although it's traditionally considered kind of a pathway that fewer people take to arrive to perfectionistic striving. And that has to do with households in which children are either abused or neglected in some way, and therefore there is this true sense of an environment in which the perfectionism actually does decrease in some ways the likelihood that there may be some lashing out physically or emotionally, verbally toward the child. And that you can often find those households look very different from the prototypes I was describing earlier with really high achieving parents, et cetera. But in fact, they send the same kind of messaging, which is basically that your behavior makes you lovable, being flawless makes you lovable or acceptable in some way. And I think Chris's story really brings home that households in which and children who are raised who receive that kind of messaging are really at risk for developing perfectionistic beliefs.
Well, what's interesting, Gordon, is that Chris, as he describes, went into therapy to, you know, he saw his marriage falling apart and got some insight about this survival mechanism, but how it didn't work as he was an adult.
Yes, and Chris, thanks for phoning in, Chris, because often perfectionists don't seek help, and to go on a national radio show and talk about it is amazingly challenging for most people who have a tendency to be perfect. And just to amplify what Patricia was saying, perfection for striving for many people is a compensation for things that haven't gone ideal. It tends to reflect a sort of need for control or predictability. Perfectionists tend to be people who hate uncertainty. Most people hate it, but they really hate it. And it's almost a coping strategy for many people. And the concern we have is that in this trying to make yourself feel better about what's been going on in your life, you're setting yourself up for the stress and the distress and maybe the health problems. And as we've seen in Chris' case, the relationship problems that can ultimately ensue when you're trying to make up for something that wasn't great in the past. But most important for people is to get the message that if they think they need help, go out and get it. It's not easy to do. Perfectionists tend to stigmatize themselves, saying, you know, I'm a weak person if I need help. But we have far too many examples of people who didn't get the help, and then we end up hearing some very unpleasant stories later, often with people that nobody knew they were suffering at all.
Chris, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Tim from Abington to join our conversation.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, as a perfectionist myself, I can really relate to everything that your guests have said. And I just wanted to share a story that when I was an undergraduate music major, my private piano teacher made a comment about another piano professor. And he said about her that she makes the most beautiful mistakes. Huh. And for me, it was really an eye-opening comment, sort of a reality check. You know, the idea that mistakes will happen, and making music is more than being perfect, but about recovering from your mistakes. And I found that to be helpful to think about as a musician, but also in life as well.
Well, Tim, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Patricia a chance to respond to the idea of making beautiful mistakes.
I love the saying, I have to say.
Me too.
And that part of what I think can be effective in therapy at times actually has to do with embracing mistakes, inviting mistakes, purposefully engaging in mistakes, so that individuals or perfectionists could learn that process of coping, could carefully track and monitor what are the outcomes. I assume the world is going to tilt off its axis if I make a mistake. And when, in fact, they make an error and say, gosh, I did something wrong, if a boss says, oh, well, just fix it, suddenly all of their beliefs about how terrible it is to err in some way, or how essential it is for them to be flawless, really gets challenged. So I like that notion of embracing mistakes, thinking about them differently, maybe even seeking them out in some ways. And I guess that gets back to the point I was making earlier about inviting risk-taking.
Tim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Patricia DiBartolo, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
She's professor of clinical psychology and adolescent anxiety disorders at Smith College. Gordon Flett, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's been a great experience.
A great experience for us as well. We really wanted to do the show, and he's a professor of psychology at York University in Toronto. For more information about Radio Times, including Facebook and Twitter, and how to download a podcast, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.